Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction, the podcast in which we talk about recipes, about cookies, and how to make them. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Steven DeGennaro, who has a PhD in how to make cookies. Steven?
Dr. Steven DeGennaro, cookie making extraordinaire.
Just kidding. We don't really talk about cookies. We talk about science fiction movies and the science therein. For the next two episodes, Steven and I are going to discuss a quartet of very entertaining monster movies known, officially, as the Monsterverse.
I believe it's official. I think it's referred to that in official official sources. It's canon.
But what you're saying is when I said it might be official or it might not, I was not wrong.
You are technically correct.
Don't split hairs with me. You know, it's something that I think genre fans have been waiting for a long time. Superhero franchises are great. And Fast and the Furious movies are great. And, you know, movies for kids and movies for young women, young boys, young adults, young children. You know, I finally feel like I have a relatively mindless blockbuster franchise for me. And yeah. I think that's why I like these movies so much, despite, as you'll hear, each one has its own special little flaws and foibles. But for the most part, I really enjoy this whole series. And I'm really glad that they are successful. I don't know how long they'll keep going because it's impossible to make one of these cheaply. But, you know, if they make two or three more, I'll be fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm not as big of a fan of monster movies just as a subgenre, as a milieu, as you are. It's okay. I will confess here and now that when I saw this Godzilla movie, the first of these MonsterVerse movies in 2014. Incidentally, I saw it at a theater in Gonzales, Texas, during the downtime in between when we did rehearsals and when we started the shoot for Found Footage 3D, because it was right exactly when we were shooting the movie. But this was the very first Godzilla movie that I ever saw. I have never seen the original Godzilla. I've never seen any of its 30 whatever sequels.
Of course, this is not the first time that America has tried to tackle Godzilla. There was an infamously bad release in 85 called Godzilla 85, which that's what it was called here. I believe overseas it was called Return of Godzilla, but it's really bad. And then of course there is the Americanized version of the 1954 original, and I guess that's a good, like, training wheels version of Godzilla if you're a kid, maybe. But, you know, once you're an adult kaiju monster fan, you should definitely watch the original Japanese version of Godzilla, not the Americanized version, because it's made to be more trivial and more spectacle, whereas the Japanese original is meant to be horrifying and pointed. And then, of course, there were tons and tons of sequels out of the company Toho that produces all the Godzilla films. And, you know, in America, Godzilla has always kind of enjoyed like a secondary life as, you know, just a fun pop culture character, but it's certainly nothing that belongs to us, but we, you know, certainly enjoy his pop culture presence. And so as somebody who loves a lot of the original series, I kind of like that the American films are big and bombastic, but they're just as silly, except for the inaugural film. And I think it suffers a bit from being a bit too stodgy. So let's talk about 2014's Godzilla, directed by Gareth Edwards, who directed a great indie film called Monsters. And on a lot of, based on that movie, I think, he got a lot of attention and got this gig. Steven, what is your take on Godzilla 2014?
So first of all, I just realized that I lied. This is not the first Godzilla movie I ever saw. I saw the Roland Emmerich Godzilla in the theaters when it came out in 1990, whatever it was, 95, 6.
See, I was not going to mention that, even though I did say I was going to talk about the American version. I intentionally skipped that because I knew you were going to bring it up. So I do not like the Roland Emmerich Godzilla. I know a lot of
people.
You don't
like any Roland Emmerich movies.
No. I don't hate it. I think it definitely has some moments and some visual cues and a couple of funny bits. I don't hate it, but I don't think it really fits Godzilla. It feels more like Giant Monster Attack New York, which is fine, but it doesn't feel like a Godzilla movie. There's really very little personality to Godzilla in that film. So let's not talk about Roland Emmerich. Let's talk about 2014.
So I had actually seen that movie, which I guess in part I kind of blocked it out because it doesn't really feel like a Godzilla movie. Look, when I think of Godzilla, I think of the big buff lizard dude in a, you know, the rubber suit it being a big part of it. Although in this, obviously, there is no rubber suit. It's all CGI. But it kind of, you know, they clearly modeled it, you know, whereas the Roland Emmerich one, they just decided to, like, kind of throw out the design of Godzilla, the traditional design of Godzilla, and kind of start from scratch. Whereas this, they're just like, let's take it and let's run with it and try to make the CGI version of it. You were right. I like, of the four of these movies, this is my least favorite of the four of them. And it's largely because it's a movie that's trying very hard not to be silly and ends up sillier as a result.
Yep. Oh, yeah, totally agree. I think that is the main problem with this film, is that it tries very hard to be stone-faced, serious. And the concept is, you know, innately goofy from this context. It's not, you know, obviously it's not all that goofy if you know the 1954 version pretty well, because it's kind of an indictment and a screed and a horrible document about, you know, nuclear proliferation, atomic destruction. Right. And
that made sense. I mean, that was a thing,
for,
right?
You know, the bombs dropping on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and it's not subtle and it's very powerful. The American Godzillas are like, hey, it's fun to watch buildings fall down.
Yeah. No, and, you know, in the context of Japan in the 1950s, that made sense. It seems like, on the one hand, this movie was attempting to sort of replicate that tone and the seriousness of purpose of that one. But by the same token, what is it saying? I mean, there's kind of like, it's an environmental message to it, I guess, but like, I know there's a little bit of an environmentalism thing that feels kind of tacked on and thrown in, but that's not, it's, you know, that was a very, like you said, that was a country processing a massive trauma, like World War II, and then World War II ending and us entering the nuclear age and Japan being the only country in the world that had, you know, witnessed it firsthand. And so, you know, there's a poignancy to that, and there's a way which you're allowed to treat that seriously in that. But this, I don't know. Anyway, let's talk about the plot a little bit, such as it is, and then we can use that to jump off into some of the terrible science and some of the terrible artistic decisions.
I'll start. Bryan Cranston is a nuclear scientist who, now you go.
Who works with his wife at a plant in Japan, and big, spindly looking, kind of almost a little bit like the Cloverfield monster looking thing comes and I guess it wants to eat the radiation. And it destroys the facility in the process, and it becomes an exclusion zone. And then we cut to 10 years later-ish, 15 years later. I can't remember exactly how long it is. Interestingly enough, in those 15 years, Bryan Cranston's haircut has not changed one single hair, which I found fascinating. He's still wearing the same bad wig in the future as he was back in the past.
Right. Normally when they put a bad wig on an actor, it's because they're going to remove it for some reason later.
Right. You're going to see like bald Bryan Cranston or Bryan Cranston with a modern haircut. But no, he's still wearing the same 70s wig in the 2000s or the 2014 as he was in the – but it can't have been the 70s either. That's the thing, right? When was – like if this came out in 2014 and Aaron Taylor Johnson is in his mid-20s.
I don't even know who that is.
So he would have been born in 1990. He's the – you don't know who that is. He's the main character of this movie. So this must have been like 1995 that this happened. Why do I think it feels like it's supposed to be the 70s?
It just seems to me a large problem with this movie is that they weren't really sure how serious the tone should be. So it has kind of this stone-faced perspective that, you know, shows respect for the character and respect for their own film, but it almost suffers from being too Niles Crane. You know what I mean? It needs to be a little looser.
Niles Crane is funny. Niles Crane is hilarious. He's the straight man, right? He's, you know, Niles Crane, you know, there's a version of that tone that works as comedic tone by taking things seriously. This just, it's not fun. It's joyless. It's not, it's just,
you know what? I think it is fun, but I think there's a lot of dull stretches between the fun. And yeah. I really kind of, I respect the whole, we're going to show the creature very piecemeal. Here's the foot, here's a shoulder in the shadows, in the fog, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, we're different than we were in 1975 when you were like doling out Jaws in little frames. We're different now.
But also then it does all that. I can live with that as a decision. But then it finally shows Godzilla, and Godzilla looks more or less exactly like a guy in a CG version of a guy in a rubber suit. It's, you know, he doesn't move like a guy in a rubber suit, you know, all of the sort of rubber suitiness of, you know, but he's still built like a guy, and he looks like a weightlifter, you know, he's about to ask you which way to the squat machine. Like, hey man, how you doing? How much can you bench? He's got like this big, Godzilla, he's got no neck. Down. He's got these big hulking arms that he can't put all the way down.
You know what though? Even though Godzilla's very strong, his arms are really small. So I bet you he couldn't bench all that.
They're small, but they're also like, they come out away from his body the way that like one of those beefed up bodybuilders does, yes. Because his muscles are so big that his arms can never quite rest at his sides comfortably. That's what Godzilla looks like to me. It's even worse, I think, in the third movie. But if you're going to spend all this time like, oh God, what is this new Godzilla going to look like? What's he going to look like? What's he going to look like? Oh, he looks exactly like the old Godzilla. Okay. So can we talk about the structure of this movie, right? Because we've said, okay, well, you know, this thing comes and it, you know, it smashes the
nuclear,
right, attacks the nuclear facility. The facility, you know, goes critical or whatever, supposedly, and it's now become an exclusion zone. But 15 years in the future, Bryan Cranston refuses to believe that, you know, he saw some signature on the thing, and he doesn't think it was actually just a nuclear accident. He thinks it was a monster or whatever it was. And so he calls up his – so he has a son, played by Aaron Taylor Johnson, yeah, I mean, exactly like that. If you want to, like, to me, like the stodginess of this, like the joylessness of this thing lays at the feet of both the script and him. And he's a great actor. His performance in Nocturnal Animals is one of the scariest things I've ever seen in my life, horror movie or non-horror movie. I think it's brilliant. It's completely unrecognizable. He makes some amazingly interesting choices. It's fantastic. And it shows just this massive amount of range. He is just a wet blanket of nothingness in this movie.
Yeah, he really is. He's just a very basic square jaw character, and he's not very compelling.
Yeah, and you know, and they try to give him some sort of like, I mean, they literally, they're like, oh, save the cat. We can do one better. How about save the Japanese kid? Like, and there's a whole sequence where he like takes this little, you know, maybe 8-year-old Japanese kid who accidentally gets cut off from his parents on the train, and he has to like save him and bring him back. It never has any bearing on the plot later on. It never, you know,
it really just feels like, oh, we need a hero moment.
Right. We need to make sure that our audience really, really likes him. So let's make sure, you know, that let's have him save a kid. And then the audience will be, you know, it's so screenwriting 101 and so transparent and inorganic, and just feels like a, you know, a choice that the screenwriters are making.
Formula. Like, this is, we need a, you know, somewhere in act 2 we need this. But I will say though that, like, narratively that sequence might be clunky and everything, but visually I think it's fantastic. It's one of the best moments, the best scenes in the whole movie.
Oh, it's cool. Yeah, again, and it would have been just as effective and just as cool if he hadn't had a kid to take care of, like if he was just fighting for his own life. But of course, if he's fighting for his own life, that doesn't make him a hero. He's got to be fighting for somebody else's life too. But the real problem with this movie is that, you know, I've puzzled over this decision for many years at this point, of the choice to, like, you know, cast Bryan Cranston at the top of his popularity. Like, this was right as Breaking Bad was ending or right after it ended. Like, Bryan Cranston was one of the biggest stars in the world at that point. And so, you know, then they spend the first 15 minutes with Bryan Cranston as the main character of this story. And then they're like, nah, we're going to go with his way less interesting son in the future is going to be the main character. And then we're going to, you know, we're going to have him be a sidekick, like a crazy sidekick character for like 15 minutes. And then we're going to kill him off. And we're just going to follow the son.
That bummed you out.
Part because Bryan Cranston is just a way more compelling actor, at least in this particular movie, and a way more compelling character. He has personality. Like we get a sense of who he is, right? Even if it's just oh, crazy kind of conspiracy kook who happens to be right.
Plus, he's the guy who deals with this horrible tragedy that we witness. And then it's like, all right, it's his journey. We're gonna watch him going on this journey to thwart this monster. And his main motivation is the damn monster killed his beloved wife.
Yeah.
Okay, it's simple, but there's our through line. And then
right.
I think it kind of. It almost feels like they thought, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if we went like Psycho route and kill off Bryan Cranston and then he's not the main character anymore. And then they got notes that were like, no, we need him in the movie.
Yeah, no, you're right. Because like, if you're going to do that, then he should have died in that opening sequence.
Yeah, that would have mean I wouldn't have enjoyed that more, but it might have been more interesting because now that, instead of him just being a secondary character who's there for exposition.
That's a choice, right? That's a choice. That's a valid choice. Like that's a, you know, whereas this just feels like you said, is this wishy-washy middle, like, oh, well, we have Bryan Cranston in the movie, but like, and he's the biggest person in the movie. So we can't really just kill him off in the opening sequence, but we've kind of wrote this whole thing about the sun. So
but it does kind of play. I always have these conspiracy theories about, you know, post-production, but it really kind of does play like he should die in that moment. And then those later moments are kind of peppered in as reshoots. It feels secondary, but the action sequences, the Godzilla sequences, are legitimately cool. They really are. They did not, they had, you know, there's some creativity there. There's some, you know, interesting shot compositions and choices. Once they finally get past the whole teasing of the, and there's like two or three moments where they're about to show us something and then they cut away as if to tell people, wait till later, you'll get your dessert, it's coming. But we already paid our $9, man. Give us dessert now.
Well, so, you know, what made me excited about this movie was the combination of monsters, which I think is a fantastic movie and everybody should go seek out. And then the trailer for this, which, you know, was built, the first trailer I think was built largely around that this halo jump that happens about two thirds of the way through the movie.
Oh, right. Where
in this big smoky wasteland, you know, above where the monsters are fighting and they're, you know, have these red streamers of smoke coming out of the side of the things. And I was like, man,
super
this
cool.
Stuff is beautiful. It's gorgeous.
Super
it's,
cool. Yeah.
Right. It's exactly what I think, what made monsters so good was this exact same kind of visuals and using CG, but it's done in a way that like doesn't, you know, that feels beautiful. And that sequence is still great, but it's also, by the time we get to that sequence in the movie, like, I don't care, you know, like, I don't care about, like, so the other thing about this, the thing that bothers me narratively about this most of all is that for all of their sort of like, oh, well, we're going to switch main characters a third of the way through the movie. And now Aaron Taylor Johnson is going to be our main character. And now we have to figure out a way to get him involved in every single situation that now happens, no matter how, like, he starts in Japan, and then he ends up in Hawaii, and then he goes to San Francisco.
Right. Well, yeah, we need to have this character at every major moment, which is, and you're like, why?
Right.
Just write a couple more interesting characters.
Right. You know, and so, like, you know, one of the things that I like about Roland Emmerich's disaster movies, and you know, on the Irwin Allen model, is the ensemble nature of them. Like it tells four or five different mini stories about these characters.
Right. And it also helps fill your energy meter. And it also helps fill your running time if you have three or four subplots in addition to the main character plot.
But it's hard to, like, it takes you out of the story when it's just like, oh, wait a second. He happened to end up in this place where they're about to do this halo jump because they need to set off this bomb. And oh, by the way, he just happens to be a demolitions expert. So, and he's the only, I'm the best hope you've got. You've got to let me go in and do it. And they're like, all right, I guess we have to let him do it. It's a good thing he happened to be here. The world's foremost expert in this particular type of bomb, right when we needed it the most. And just like, it's one coincidence like that after another for the entire rest of the movie. And it's just,
that's true.
Which, if he was a compelling character, if he was an, like, you know, they did something similar a little bit with like Brad Pitt's character in World War Z, but in that case, it was Brad Pitt's job to kind of go around the world and fix all these things. Whereas he just kind of keeps stumbling into these situations, and he's just not a compelling character. So it's just like I would rather see a new character who has some personality in that defuse the bomb rather than him. And of course, you know, for all of our, you know, this is a problem in this movie. It's a problem not so much in the second movie because of the time period it's set in, but definitely in the third movie. That for all of the like advanced technology that is posited in all of these movies, it always comes down to somebody has to, like, oh, we can't set off the bomb remotely. Somebody has to sacrifice their life or risk their life or whatever to like, we have freaking bunker buster bombs. We have smart drones. We have like automated things that, you know, but of course, like, oh, all of those happen to be broken right now. So our main character is going to have to like find his pluck and go in and do it manually. And either, you know, in the third movie, spoiler alert.
Well, that, you know, that's just the need for
somebody has to sacrifice. Yeah, I get it, but it's just like, it's just funny because it's just like that.
And sometimes it's done gracefully, yeah. Like in Aliens, when, you know, Gorman goes back for Vasquez and they never liked each other and they sacrifice each other together. And you're like, yeah, because it's a great moment between two secondary characters that were real. And then, you know, you're like, you crave that in other movies.
Yeah.
Skull Island has a bit of it, but this movie does not have any of that kind of like.
No.
Commando personality, yeah. Let's call it.
Right. And they keep cutting back to Elizabeth Olsen, who plays Aaron Taylor-Johnson's wife. And we're supposed to care about it because she is in the city where some of this stuff is happening. And but she also, I mean, another fantastic actress who has given absolutely nothing to do in this movie and has absolutely no character or personality or anything.
Most of her stuff she's connected to a phone for most of this.
Yeah,
movie,
she's completely like wasted.
She's receiving or giving exposition, usually receiving.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's first. Yeah, it's not great for any actor, but for Elizabeth Olsen,
yeah,
come on.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the science of this.
Yeah, well, let's go back. I want you to do a quick recap, if you would, of one of my favorite scientific statements that we covered many, many, many episodes ago, and just run through it again. Is the scale problem with kaiju monsters?
Yeah,
the scale problem.
So the scaling problem has to do with the fact that if you know the strength of a limb. Say, is proportional to the cross-sectional area. So like your leg's ability to hold you up is in part, is related to how, the circumference. If you took a piece of string and wrapped it around your thigh and, you know, like a ham bone and take a look at that circle that it makes, like the strength of your leg comes from the area of, you know, your bones mostly, but the cross-sectional area of your bone, the bone down the middle of your leg. But your weight, your mass, is proportional to your volume. So area is proportional to your length squared, and volume is proportional to your length cubed. So if you took something that was, you know, like a human being, or, you know, if you simplify it, let's say it's, a spherical cow is one of the things that happens in physics all the time. Like imagine a cow is just a sphere. If you double the size of that sphere.
Wait a minute. Back up a second. Spherical cow is the standard measuring stick for scientists?
You can Google. It's not, it is, you know, imagine a spherical cow because a sphere is a lot easier to deal with than a complex shape of a cow.
Well, why is the cow necessary?
Well, it just is. I don't know. It's one of those weird traditions in, I guess the joke is that we kind of model everything as a sphere. So like you take a person, you know, when we try to figure out like what's the terminal velocity of a person jumping out of an airplane? Well, imagine the person was spherical and they weighed 200 pounds. Like that's the simplest way to calculate that because that's the simplest way to figure out what the air resistance is on that thing. Is to just imagine it as a sphere. And then you can, you know, then from there you make more complex models if you need to know it to, you know, but if you're just trying to do sort of rough calculations back of the envelope, like exact, you know, what's the rough, you know, if you dropped a cow out of an airplane, how fast would it fall? You can model it as a sphere and you know, it's close enough for the first order approximation. Gotcha. So we have a spherical cow. So imagine we have a spherical cow that's of a foot wide. It's a little mini spherical cow. The cross-sectional area of that, if you cut the sphere in half, you'd have a circle. And that's the size of that circle is pi r squared or pi times 1 squared. If you double the radius of this sphere, that cross-sectional area goes up by a factor of 4 because it goes up like squared. But the volume of that sphere and hence the mass of that sphere goes up by a factor of 4 squared, which is 8. So it goes up by a factor of 8. So you now have the strength of this thing has only increased by a factor of 4, but the mass that it has to support has gone up by a factor of 8. So it is technically now half as strong.
So what you're saying, it would be stronger, but much, much slower.
No, I'm just saying that like you can't just scale something. In other words, this is one of the reasons why if you look at,
In order for Godzilla to work, we talked about this before, his arms and legs would have to be 4 times the size of his torso.
Well, he's you know, not necessarily four times the size of his torso, but like the, like you couldn't just take a normal lizard and make that lizard the size of a skyscraper. Its legs would not be able to support its weight. They would just break.
Right. Its body would crush its leg. Right. Right.
And so it would have to, which is why like elephants have, you know, you, if you took an elephant and shrunk it down, you wouldn't, like, it doesn't look like a mouse, right? It, the, its proportions are very, very different than a mouse's would be, because a mouse doesn't need all that much, doesn't need to support that much weight on its sort of little tiny legs.
Right.
Whereas an elephant needs big, thick legs, you know, or a deer. Like if you took a deer and scaled it up to the size of an elephant without scaling it, you know, without making its legs thicker proportionately, its legs would just snap under the weight. So this is the scale problem. I think they mostly get around this in the case of Godzilla. I think he actually does feel, I mean, like he, like I said, he does feel like a bodybuilder. He feels like his, you know, his arms are short, but they're powerful looking. His legs are big, thick, you know, trunky looking things, and his tail is big and thick. And so like he you know, he looks
feasible.
You know, without doing the calculations, right? Without sitting and doing the Mutos, on the other hand, are a lot harder to for the same reason that the Cloverfield monster.
Yeah. Now these things are designed, what? They're like two legs, a head, and a tail.
Yeah, and they're but they've got these like long, thin, spindly legs.
Yeah.
You know, that again would have a much harder time supporting the weight of something that big.
Plus, it always looks like it wants to pitch forward, like a turtle.
I mean, it kind of looks like a bat crawling around on its elbows. It's one of the other things it kind of looks a little bit like.
Yeah, Cloverfield-y a little.
Yeah, it looks a lot like, I mean, it reminds me a lot of the Cloverfield monster, and has the same issues as far as the scale and the proportion go.
I have one science question. I knew you'd have several lecture points, but you mentioned the halo thing where they're falling. Is it realistic that you could fall in that kind of like organized phalanx like that?
Oh yeah, skydivers do it all the time. They do all sorts
it's a beautiful visual, and every time I'm watching it, I'm like, not one of them wanders off course. That's wild.
Are you kidding me? Have you never seen like a skydive troop, like the people that all skydive at the same time, and they do like tricks and they link up and then they break apart and they form snowflakes and they do all sorts of cool, interesting mid-air acrobatics as a sport. So yes, absolutely, they could.
I just love that whole concept of paratrooping directly into a kaiju battle.
Yeah. So it starts, it's literally minute one. It's the very first scene of this movie. The Sato, the Japanese scientist guy, gets called in because this mining facility accidentally dug too deep and broke through into a cavern, which is how they discover the Muto female or male or the eggs. I don't know. I keep track of it. But one of those kaijus
is down. It was 4 movies ago, damn it.
it's of so little importance. It's like, okay, giant monster or monster eggs. It gets out. It's a mining company, and there's this giant open pit mine, and they expect us to believe that they kind of accidentally punched a hole into a massive, massive underground cavern. Like, they didn't do any sort of seismic surveys of this area before they started building a giant mine on it. You could punch into a small cavern, maybe, I guess, but like their entire mine is built on top of this massive gaping void in the earth, and they somehow just missed it. They didn't know that it was there, and it took them by surprise. I don't really buy that. Sorry.
Did not even think about that, but it is a huge, that is.
So that jumped out at me like right away, right from minute one. So Bryan Cranston gets told that there was a nuclear meltdown, and that's the reason why they had to shut down the plant. That's why his wife died. But he, of course, doesn't believe it, and he still lives in Japan, and he keeps trying to sneak into the exclusion zone. And he goes into the exclusion zone, and he's wearing a mask, like a gas mask, and he takes it off to prove that there isn't actually radiation there. I don't even know where to begin. I feel like even you, Scott, should be able to figure out what's wrong with that picture. I mean, we've talked, I think, in the past about the people taking their masks off.
Well, I always just mean, now that we're discussing it, I always figured that what you're laughing at is a mask protects you from a lack of oxygen or a hostile environment.
Right.
You're collecting that radiation whether you're wearing that suit or not.
Well, yeah, and I don't think he's even wearing a suit. He's just wearing, he's got the mask on. And like, so if there's radiation there, it's getting all over his body.
Right, right.
The mask is not really helping with
it. Like, I got it right.
Yeah. Not breathing into his lungs is probably good, because that's, you know, it's going to do a lot of damage the more you breathe it in. But taking the mask off and going, well, it doesn't smell like radiation. Like, what? You can't tell whether or not something has radiation. Like, you're not going to die instantly. from that kind of radiation. Like, if there's radiation there, it means he's now breathing into his lungs, and 10 years from now, he's going to get cancer. Or if it's particularly bad, it means that maybe in a week, he's going to die from all of the radiation he's getting. But he literally, like, he doesn't have a Geiger counter. He doesn't have anything actually measuring the radiation. He just decides that because he took his mask off and didn't die instantly, it must be, everything must be okay.
It proves his conspiracy theory true.
If there was enough radiation there to kill him instantly when he took off his mask, he would have been dead already anyway.
Because, yeah, that level of radiation would just short you out, right?
Right, exactly. Like, it would have already, you know, fried his brain.
Is the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste facility a real thing?
Yes, that is a real thing. And it poses a really interesting conundrum, and it's this weird, there's this confluence of sort of graphic design and safety mechanism, whatever else. Because the nuclear waste, a lot of the kinds of nuclear waste that get produced in modern nuclear reactors is expected to last tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. And so they have tried to sort of come up with, there's been this whole subfield of people trying to figure out, is there any way that we could warn a future civilization that they will understand? If you presume, okay, if civilization ended tomorrow, as we know it, and all of our languages were lost and all of our symbology was lost and, you know, there was no, you know, like, can you create some sort of symbol that is a warning to people that people would just instinctively know is stay out of this place, that doesn't require any cultural context, that doesn't require any knowledge of current languages? And it's a fascinating idea. Like, if somebody came across this place 100,000 years from now with absolutely no idea of what our culture was like, would they know, don't go in here because it will kill you?
A more interesting question would be, what if somebody came across like the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste facility 100,000 years from now and completely understood, no, get out, stay away, but didn't think it really applied to them anymore? Like, oh, come on. Maybe, you know, it'd have been like us digging through like Egyptian cursed temples. Yes. Oh, come on. That doesn't apply
to us.
That's a
really good point. No, exactly. You're right. Like, oh, I think this thing is saying that this place is cursed, but you know, yeah, you know, you're exactly right.
We could call it future hubris. No, wait, now we have to have a sidebar here because you're gonna hate me for asking this, but is there a story in this? A scientist comes up with an idea to shoot all of our nuclear toxic waste in a satellite into deep space.
Well, I'll tell you why we haven't done that and we probably never would. Because rockets blow up more often than you might think. And if you stick a bunch of nuclear waste onto a rocket and it pulls a Challenger and explodes 5 miles up, you have completely contaminated the entire Earth with a massive amount of nuclear radiation that will give us all three-eyed children for the next 50,000 years. So there's no way to get it to space.
So what you're saying is scientists have considered this option.
Oh, absolutely.
Shoot our toxic
yes.
waste into outer space.
Yes. You can't. The problem is getting it up into outer space is an extremely dangerous proposition. And so it's better to just bury it.
We are awful.
Yeah. So scientifically, towards the end of the movie, okay, so I don't really understand the Mutos at all. Like, I don't, or the Titans, really. Like, there's a sense in which, like, these movies kind of tip over from science fiction into fantasy, and you have to go with it. But it also, like, they try to be science fiction movies, but it doesn't work. Like, how is Godzilla? I guess is the question that I want to ask.
He's a mutated lizard from the Bikini Atoll bomb test.
Okay, but that doesn't, I mean, like... So the question that I keep asking myself as I'm watching this is like, how do they evolve? Godzilla, let's say Godzilla was a mutated lizard thing that happened because of nuclear radiation, blah, blah, blah. That's not, I don't think the backstory in this movie though. Let's, you know, in the canon of the MonsterVerse, that's not how Godzilla is created. Godzilla is a titan that predates all of humanity by millions of years and fought an alien.
We woke him up, right?
But it particularly comes up in the case of the Mutos because the whole plot of this thing is the male Muto and the female Muto are trying to meet up so that they can get their freak on and have some Muto babies. That implies that like they were born at some point, but where are they? Like, how do you evolve something like that And then there's no record of it anywhere in the fossil record. There's no record of it. Have they just been sleeping for billions, millions of years at this point?
Are there only two of them ever?
Right, exactly.
They were both male. Where did they come from?
There happens to be two of them and they happen to be male and female. And then they lay eggs and there's thousands and thousands of eggs, which is, you know, obviously supposed to raise the stakes. But again, it really sort of it raises the question like –
Right. If their biology is to create thousands of eggs, how were there only two of them in the historical record?
Right. How have they not taken over the world already 1,000 times over? Because obviously, if this patch of eggs hatches, humanity screwed. There's going to be 1,000 of these things running around, and each of them is going to have 1,000 babies, and then, you know, before you know it, it's just mutos as far as the eye can see. So it's just like the you know, I think by the time we get to the fourth movie, it just, you know, it hand waves. Oh, Hollow Earth. They all came out of the Hollow Earth, and that's where they've all evolved. And, you know, we'll get there when we get there in terms of my feelings on the Hollow Earth theory.
Yeah, I think you just nailed a good transition point, too, because it's like I said before, as much as I respect the effort to do something straight-faced sci-fi, it's just you're always going to come up against this problem. You're always going to hit this wall in when you're dealing with kaiju movies is you can only follow or extrapolate real science so far. And then you have to just get fantasy.
Yeah, exactly. And the problem comes for me in a lot of these movies when the attempt to explain it scientifically calls attention to how completely unscientific and silly it is. And so it would be better to just not even have it than it is to try to like find some way to.
It'd be funny if somebody tried to do a completely scientifically accurate Godzilla movie and it was just boring. It was like people just sitting around at the desk talking.
So let's talk about the other aspect of this movie and all of these movies in general that really, you know, there was a scene in this that brought it to the forefront for me because this movie, in some sense, really wanted to have its cake and eat it too. So at the climax of this movie, Elizabeth Olsen is in the hospital with her kid as she's a nurse and she's trying to help people. And the Mutos and Godzilla are outside battling each other. And it keeps cutting back to her in the hospital and all these hundreds of people that are in this hospital, they're going to die if the monsters come and destroy their building. Because they want like that stakes. They want you to feel like, oh no, like this has consequences. And then they cut back out to the monsters literally knocking over skyscrapers, destroying buildings left and right. Like, and so it's like we want to believe that these two characters that we kind of sort of care about because we've been told we're supposed to care about them are in danger. But we also have to ignore the fact that every time they knock over a skyscraper, 10,000 people just got killed.
Yeah, the stakes are all over the place in this whole franchise. It really is because I mean, there's some crazy city destruction in these movies, and I guess you know. But the argument on the other side would be that cliche is part and parcel of the whole Godzilla franchise from beginning to end, which is even in 1968 when they were doing guys in giant suits hitting cardboard buildings. You could also think. Are those buildings full of people?
But in the original, and correct me if I'm wrong because I haven't seen it, but in the original, wasn't that part of what made it a horror movie? Was his like ability just the mass destruction of this entire city?
Yeah, just and like blind, and it was not even necessarily malevolent, just completely blind, stumbling destruction.
Right. Yeah. And then the other thing that I thought was funny at the very end of the movie, like one of the very final shots, there's like a news thing. And there's a little chyron along the bottom that says, Savior of our city. And the shot is Godzilla walking through just leveled San Francisco, just completely and utterly destroyed, smoking ruins, buildings falling down, buildings, destroyed, fires raging everywhere. And it says Savior of our city on the bottom of it. And it just feels like a really weird juxtaposition. What I'm getting at is I don't really buy.
Yeah, those hot takes would come later. I think the first several days would be about death tolls and, emergency services. I don't know if we'd be labeling this monster our savior 30 seconds.
Like, oh, thank God. Yeah, thank God they only destroyed 3/4 of the city instead of the whole city.
Oh, my God. We still have 25% of our population left.
Yeah, and I don't think, more fundamentally, I don't buy that, if this thing actually happened in our world, that we would view that as a good, these monsters had a giant fight in one of our cities. They all suck. None of those monsters were good.
It's a good stand-up routine. Godzilla's not the hero. If Godzilla was a hero, he'd be dragging every monster out into the beach.
Yeah, he'd be dragging them into the ocean and drowning
them. If Godzilla
him.
Really cared, he wouldn't be kicking the shit out of people in Hong Kong Central.
Like, there's a point in the third movie where he literally smashes the guy into a building to hurt him. Yep. And just smashes right through the building. By the time of that movie, they were, I think, they let us know that there wasn't actually people, like, they had evacuated the city. So we now get to destroy it. Guilt-free.
No, you do respect that. A lot of superhero movies and dinosaur movies and what a lot of big destruction yeah. movies will throw that in, by the way. Like, the city was quarantined yesterday. And, you know, yeah. on one hand, it feels like, you know, kind of bandage screenwriting. But on the other hand, it does kind of alleviate that storytelling yeah. glitch.
You don't have to feel guilty about it anymore.
Right. We're not even guilty, but just questioning. Like, really? Yeah. Like, how many people died when that building fell? Like yeah. 10,000 or two or zero.
So what are your grades for this one, Scott? What would you give the original Godzilla?
I think the original Godzilla is has moments of brilliance and some fun stuff. And some, you know, even some of the dry stuff is compelling. But on the most part, I don't love it. I think it's a 3.5 out of 5-star movie, B-.
Yeah, I would give it probably a C- on artistic integrity. Man, when I was so excited the first time I saw it because I was expecting greatness, and it was definitely not great. And then when I rewatched it last week or whatever, I was like, oh, this is actually, you know, now that I've sort of settled into this being what it is, I kind of like it a little bit better. But then I realized that was all just the Bryan Cranston's part, and then he died, and I was like, oh, yeah, no, right. From the rest, from here on out, the rest of this movie is just really dumb and boring. So I give it a C-. I will give it a D, which is, I think, being generous on the scientific accuracy, you know, solely because the Godzilla scale thing actually might kind of work a little bit accidentally, probably not on purpose.
All right. So then we move on 3 years later.
Yeah. Or 30 years earlier.
30 years earlier, like Steven said. To Kong Skull Island, the second of the four MonsterVerse movies. And this is about the end of the Vietnam War. A platoon of soldiers and scientists are on their way to this remote, isolated, uncharted island under false pretenses by this sneaky John Goodman. And it is basically then a A to B to C adventure movie where the platoon and the scientists are mostly picked off by various creatures as we discover that Kong dominates Skull Island and anything that comes near him gets the shit beat out of it or eaten. And it has more pop songs than more 70s.
I mean, yeah.
It is the most jukeboxy of the MonsterVerse movies. It is...
For sure.
Paper thin and kind of shallow, but very fun. Like, I think this is highly entertaining movie.
I think the first time I saw this, I think the silliness of it, for whatever reason, rubbed me the wrong way, which is a fun thing to say after, you know, all we talked about the last movie not being silly enough. But, But rewatching it this time, I'm like, you know what? This movie's fun. Like, it's one of those. I hate to use this phrase, but it really feels apt. Shut your brain off, like, and just enjoy it. You know, like you can't think too hard about almost any of the stuff.
No, I'll agree with the second part. I hate the shut your brain off thing because I know it's meant as a metaphor, but my metaphor in return is if you shut your brain off, you'll drop dead and you'll be a corpse. So, But no, the getting used to it, like realizing, oh, this is not only popcorn movie. This is popcorn times comic book times jukebox times pulp. Like, that's what it is. And it's not trying to be deep. It's not trying to be stoic or dramatic. It's trying to be, you know, like just a quest adventure. I think you know, it does have problems. I think it has too many characters and it doesn't really know what to do with. I think that some of the editing, you know, cutting back between the A to B to C story is a little bit convoluted. But
I think the secondary characters tend to be much more compelling than, I mean, would you say that Brie Larson is the protagonist of this movie? It's hard to even, like, does it have a protagonist?
Yeah. I mean, at different points, John Goodman is the protagonist, then Brie Larson is, Tom Hiddleston is, and then Sam Jackson is kind of an anti-hero and then a psycho. For me, Shea Whigham is the star.
He's the star of everything he's in, though.
So, yeah, John Goodman is a scientist who pulls a favor out of the U.S. government and gets a military escort to this uncharted island, and he lies to everybody, and he gets eaten for his troubles, and then everybody has to run and escape, and they discover the hilarious John C. Reilly as a World War II Fugitive?
Not best part of the movie.
Survivor?
Best part of the movie. Refugee? Yeah,
I wish a little bit more had gone into the backstory. The film starts with it's a kind of a play on Hell in the Pacific, which is a 50s war movie about an American and a Japanese soldier who are crash land on an island and have to work together. So it's a little play on that, but I wish there had been a little bit more meat to that subplot. But boy, when John C. Reilly shows up halfway through, still alive, what a welcome shot at goofiness, because the movie has a sense of humor throughout, but Reilly just had just this lovable hangdog goofball.
It's goofy, but without being silly. Like he feels like a real person. He doesn't feel like, you know, you can imagine like if they just stuck like Will Ferrell in as that character. I mean, they wouldn't have, but you can imagine like, you know, Will Ferrell trying to play that character would take it up to 11. Whereas John C. Reilly like keeps him very grounded. And like, you believe in him as a real person, even though, and he brings, you know, it's just this life and this funness to the entire endeavor.
Yep.
Whatever. I mean, I think you could probably say that about just about any John C. Reilly role.
Oh yeah, he's just
anything he's in.
The guy's a genius. I don't think he's ever given a bad performance, and he's exactly what this movie needs. And he shows up at the right time. But let's talk about the monsters. This movie has some awesome creatures. My favorite being these horribly creepy giant daddy long leg bamboo leg creatures. Oh my God, I love them.
Spiders.
Love that. Yeah. Well, Daddy Longlegs is a spider, isn't it?
Actually, technically, no. Daddy Longlegs is not a spider. It is an arachnid. It is not a part of the spider family.
How dare you? Anyway, I love the giant octopus thing, kind of thing that Kong not only kills pretty handily and then just slurps up like so much sushi. You could just tell that the creature designers and director, John Vogt Roberts, or having some fun, just like, all right, what creature can we create for the land, sea, air, and throw them all in a blender? There's, you know, if you like creature design, there's a lot to enjoy here.
So let's actually talk first for, you know, let's take this in order this time. I only have a few scientific points. One of them is about, you know, the premise of this thing, which is also the premise of the original King Kong, is that, you know, there's this island and it's just shrouded in storms permanently, and therefore nobody's ever been able to reach it, or if they have, they've never been able to return. And you know, in this movie, like this new satellite system, which was actually real, this thing called Landsat, which was an actual thing, that was launched right around the time this movie took place, which was our first ability to, you know, to send up satellites into the sky and then just take pictures of the entire Earth, so that there wasn't really anything uncharted anymore. And so like, in a sense, they're setting this at the last moment it possibly could be, because nowadays, you know, there are places, obviously there's an impenetrable jungles in the Amazon or whatever, where we don't necessarily know exactly what's going on the ground.
Yeah, but it's still a documented fact. It's still a documented part of the Earth, even though it's not being technically explored. Right.
Like there's no place that a King Kong could hide. There might, you know, there might be Yeti somewhere. There might be Big Feet, but there's no King Kong. Like, we would know if there was a King Kong.
Stop stepping on my dreams.
We would have gotten, you know, pictures of it at this point. So, you know, I had actually written, when I watched the movie, I had in my notes about that an island shrouded permanently in storms is a neat idea, but it doesn't make any meteorological sense. I have since been disabused of that notion. Purely coincidentally, I happened to be watching a YouTube video that was talking about like the most inhospitable places in the world. And one of them happens to be this place called Heard Island, H-E-A-R-D, like as in I heard about Heard Island, which is off the coast of, it's like between Antarctica and Australia, I think. And it's not permanently shrouded in storms, but it is often completely shrouded in storms and basically unreachable. And it's kind of almost, you know, it is in some sense a basis for what Skull Island actually is. And it's not entirely completely, I think the way that they portray the storms in this, I mean, the idea, right, the idea of like a hurricane that's permanently just swirling around this island. And the only way to get to the island is to go through the hurricane, but the hurricane doesn't actually affect the island. The island is a beautiful sunny day, like the eye of a hurricane is. But the hurricane doesn't move. It just stays there swirling around this island permanently. And that's not really a thing. But there are islands, apparently, like Heard Island, where the storm, I mean, the storms, you know, but the storms are there on the island as well. They're not just surrounding the island and the island's fine, you know, but they are shrouded in storms in the sense that, like, it's always storming on those islands just because of the way the weather patterns work.
There's another script we can write. I wanted to set something on Heard Island.
So then, you know, so they fly through the, they fly through the storm in these helicopters that I don't honestly think, I'm not a helicopter expert, but they don't seem equipped to fly through that kind of storm, but they do. And then we have this pretty spectacular sequence of Kong just destroying one helicopter after another, after another.
I have one question about this action scene.
It's a great sequence, but
I have one question.
Maybe your question is the same as mine.
Yeah.
Why do the helicopters keep flying close enough to Kong for him to be able to grab them?
Yeah. Well, that wasn't my main question was it's a really cool little shock moment when the first helicopter is struck by a tree or whatever right. it is Kong throws, but
yeah.
You would have seen that. How would you have not seen that?
That's not necessarily true. I think if something the width of a tree is coming at you that fast,
you would have seen that like, the monkey. You would have seen that giant motion, I thought. Is what I'm saying.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I don't remember exactly how they show him. Like he's kind of hiding in the trees, isn't he?
I guess. And again, it's not I would call it a C-minus nitpick, but I was just like, "Come on, you guys are supposed to be these brilliant pilots. How would you not see that?"
Well, I think clearly they're not brilliant pilots because I think my nitpick is a D-minus nitpick because like Kong keeps just snatching helicopters out of the air.
Yeah.
They're sitting there shooting at him. There's no advantage to getting close enough to him to be able to grab the helicopter.
And you know what? This is something that bugs me throughout the entire franchise. What is it about being large that would make your flesh bulletproof?
It wouldn't, right. But think about the fact, I don't think he is bulletproof, but these are tiny projectiles as far as he's concerned. It's like you getting shot with a BB, it would hurt. It wouldn't kill
you. No, okay. I mean, if I got shot with a thousand sewing needles, eventually I bleed out.
So imagine if like somebody was shooting little metal pellets the size of like strawberry seeds at you. Like it would hurt. It wouldn't be fun.
All right. Yeah, I guess.
But like they wouldn't penetrate that far probably.
But these guys are shooting. It's not all right. They have these giant Gatling type guns and machine guns. Those would go through his chest. Come on.
They are high impact things, and yes, and especially if he got hit in the eye, it would blind him. You know, yeah, no, it's
I believe. You know. I mean, it wouldn't tear him apart like it would a human being, but those bullets would go into his body. And I don't mean in this movie. It happens in a lot of them.
No, it happens in every single giant monster movie. Yeah. Like with the other, well, it brings up the other question, which is like, in every single one of these movies. Despite the fact that these bullets are doing absolutely nothing to this thing, they never figure that out. They never like wise up to it and are like, all right,
right. You know. Or say, aim for the eyes, aim for his mouth, you know, aim for something a little. Right.
Shoot him in the balls.
They don't have balls. There's no genitals in the MonsterVerse, baby.
There are. Well, yes, there. Kong does not seem to have any genitalia that I can see. He's got a nice butt though. He's got like a nice tight little.
He does butt. Have an attractive round keister.
He's
does.
Very using. If you get a very, it's one of the things I didn't like. My favorite version of Kong is Peter Jackson's version, both the movie and the design of the the just kind of pure gorilla-ness.
Oh yeah, let's throw that sidebar in there since we're talking about the MonsterVerse, but it bears mentioning that I also adore Peter Jackson's King Kong. I even like the long version. I think it's made with palpable affection and respect, and that doesn't that alone doesn't make it a good movie, but I think it is. I think it's a sweet, fun, and occasionally creepy and dark. Great action sequences, just all around good.
Yeah, no, it's a good movie, and I like that design of Kong. I didn't like the design of Kong quite as much in this because he has much more human proportions, which is it's more faithful to the original Kong for sure. But his butt, he's got a nice butt.
So the platoon crash lands on Skull Island, and a bunch of people are killed. And then they have to get off and they have to get to the tip. What is it? The wharf at the southern tip of the island or something?
Yeah. They got to get somewhere to, they got to get to the retrieval point. Yeah. It's basically a Heart of Darkness I'm sure that was the pitch too. Was like, imagine Apocalypse Now, but there's a giant monkey.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Or a a gritty but colorful Vietnam movie, and it definitely has a dark sense of humor. It's one of the things I like most about this movie.
It has some great, yeah, set pieces that way, like the spider kill, the first spider kill, and then of course Shea Whigham's death is just brilliant.
Yeah, I watch scenes like that, and my producer hat goes on, and I'm like, all right, what's the joke here? Is the joke here that he's doing that standard action movie guy thing of, you yeah. guys go, I'll save you some, I'll buy you some time. And then yeah. he fails to.
And then Kong just swats him and it does nothing. Yeah, that's the whole joke.
That's the whole joke, but there's so many more ways to say, I mean, here, because in the way the film plays it, you can't tell if it's supposed to be funny or not.
Oh, how can you not tell it's supposed to be funny? Kong just swats him and he flies off and he screams and then explodes when he hits the rock. It's hilarious. I don't know what to tell you. I thought that was, I mean, like, it's one of my favorite moments in the movie.
I think my issue is more that joke would be funnier if we had three or four more scenes with Whigham so we know his character. Maybe. But we don't know anything. There's nothing there.
No, yeah. That's, well, would it be funnier though? Or would it be like, you know, if you tried to pull that same joke in that moment you were mentioning earlier in Aliens, it wouldn't work because you wouldn't want to see a character that you cared about just kind of thrown away that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It could just be a statement of, you know, this is what stock war movie characters say.
Right.
Before they die.
So they make a bunch of really, really dumb decisions in this movie. And that's one of the only things that I don't care for about it. In particular, they decide to cut, you know, they need to go hunting for the, God, what are they even doing? I couldn't even remember now. Like they get off the boat. And just, yeah, I guess Sam Jackson convinces them that they need to go find what's his face. This other guy that we know is dead, but
yeah, he wants to rescue. He doesn't want to leave his man behind,
right?
Yeah.
Which is not actually what he actually wants to get the munitions or whatever.
But you know, I mean, the implication is just that Sam Jackson is unhinged at this point, really.
Right. But everybody follows him. Like they all walk, like they get to the edge of this thing, and John C. Reilly, rightly, the guy who lives on this island,
that's his state. That's this movie's statement about the American military, 1978, bro.
But it isn't just the military, 1978. Like Sam Jackson can order a bunch of people into there, but John Goodman goes with them, and Tom Hiddleston goes with them, and then John C. Reilly, who is like, "Do not go down there; you will all die." Then goes with them anyway.
Yeah.
When the whole point was them to go retrieve this dude and then come back again, which means that like anybody that didn't want to go could have just hung out there and waited, and then they would have come back.
Stayed with Corey Hawkins and what's her name?
Instead, they all go into this place that's obviously dangerous, and yeah. So they all have to cross the secret, you know, the super dangerous lizard mass grave. Right. Oh, that's what it is. They get there and there's just, it's littered with corpses and skeletons, human skeletons and other things. It's basically like the feeding grounds of these lizards, which is so obvious. You don't need John C. Reilly to tell you that there's a bad idea to go in here.
As much as I like this movie and it's a good 2 hours, it really feels like an hour was cut. There are character beats that were clearly there before, because when certain characters die, there's overwrought reaction. I'm like, well, yeah. Wait, you gotta give us more.
Yeah.
There's gotta be more to these character relationships. Yeah. So it feels like
yeah.
a lot of their interplay is clearly on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, well, and you know, and also the movie clearly wanted this massive. I mean, like how many, like what, 5 or 6 helicopters, which each presumably have like 6 or 7 people in them, are killed just in that opening sequence alone. And there's like, we end up with like 15 survivors because it's like, you know, he has all of these set pieces of different ways that he wants to kill people off. And so we need that many, we need that high, that number of people so we can get the high body count. But of course, obviously then there isn't enough time. But there are some kind of interesting secondary characters. Again, John C. Reilly being the most interesting of them and Sam Jackson. But then we have, I mean, like Tom Hiddleston and Brie Larson are also just kind of in tradition, what is rapidly becoming tradition for this series, which will continue in the remaining movies. The main characters are just kind of bleh.
I think they're both fairly interesting, but what in this movie, partially because the actors are so good, but they're not necessary.
Right.
Like John Goodman and Sam Jackson could be the lead characters in this movie. And like, well, we don't have the tracker or the photographer, and the movie would virtually not even notice.
Consider this though. Because I was considering it the whole time I'm watching the movie. There might be some early on in the movie that I'm not thinking of or that I missed. But as far as I can tell, Brie Larson, I think, is the only woman with a speaking role in this entire film.
Oh, no. What's her name? Jing Tan is in it. The Chinese actress.
Oh, right. She has, like, she's the one of the other scientists.
Right. And you could get into the whole, well, there wouldn't have been women in a Vietnam platoon, so fine.
Yeah, but they're scientists. So, yeah.
But there could have been on Goodman's team. Yeah.
Well, and there were, and I guess there were some, but that, you know, that really kind of hammers it home. Like, I literally forgot that she was in this movie. As I was watching the movie, I wrote this note down because I had completely forgotten it. Whatever scene I was in, she wasn't in it. And so she had completely escaped from my brain.
She's not, she survives though.
So there are two female characters.
Yes, literally two.
It's a sausage fest is what we're saying, even though Kong has no sausage.
Oh, and you know what? I think that another thing I love about this movie, I think it's shot beautifully.
Yeah, it's great.
I think it is. Even if you hate this movie and think it's mindless, I think that it's shot beautifully. I think that Larry Fong was a cinematographer, and he is really good at genre stuff. He knows how to do stuff in an epic, mythical, larger than life.
Yeah.
I think it's a beautiful movie.
So scientific-wise, the only other thing that I had was – or actually, I had two things. One of them is there's a point where one of these guys gets torn apart by these little flying monsters, like literally torn apart, like his arms get ripped off.
Yeah.
It requires have you ever pulled on somebody's arm hard enough that you thought maybe you were going
to
pull it off?
No, but every kaiju movie has to have the Gennaro kill. You know what the Gennaro kill is, right?
The lawyer?
Yep. The lawyer from Jurassic Park sitting on the toilet. He gets yanked up.
Yeah.
So the character gets pulled off the ship and pulled apart in the air by pterodactylish type.
Pterodactylish kind of things. But they're kind of small, right? And they pull him apart in midair through just the force of their wings. Like, that.
But he was a company man.
So he had weak joints, I guess. I don't like. My point, I'm not taking issue with the fact of his death. I'm taking issue with the fact that, like, those birds did not seem like they had anywhere near powerful enough wings to generate enough force to tear a man's arm off of his body, which requires a massive amount of force. Like, it's hard. Like, if you look back at the historical record, when they used to draw and quarter people, they would tie each one of their limbs to a horse and tell the horses to run away. And if you actually look at some of the historical records of these things happening, like, a lot of times they would have to mostly cut the person's arms off with a knife or a machete or an axe or whatever, and then just leave just a little bit left for the horses to pull off, because horses on the ground aren't strong enough to pull a person apart that way. So I don't really buy that a bird in the air is.
Yeah, but it's a great visual.
It is a great moment. It is a great moment, but part of our mandate is to point out these scientific things. And then the other thing, which is cool, simultaneously cool, and also it really is just a repeat of the point I made about the first movie, which is you have these two-legged lizard creature things, the skull crawlers, and they only have two legs, right? Almost every animal on Earth, from amphibians on up, have four limbs, which means that these things either lost limbs at some point, and it's hard to imagine what evolutionary advantage they would gain from losing two of their limbs, because the way they walk around is kind of cool looking, but also not nearly as stable and probably not as fast as a four-legged creature would. And also, they only have one spare limb. If one of their limbs gets damaged, they can't walk at all, because you can't walk around with one limb. So just the evolutionary of it. But again, Hollow Earth. So I guess that's just the hand-wavy. from a scientific point of view, it's hard to imagine, you know, as cool as a two-legged creature looks, it's hard to imagine the evolutionary pathway that gets you to one.
What do you think about the science of just immediately eating a squid that attacks you in the water? Is that could probably be dangerous for your stomach, right?
Oh, no, there are people that eat squids that are still flopping around on the plate. In Japan, you can find videos of this. Like, it's a delicacy in Japan. There's these octopuses. They're dead. They're not literally alive, but they are so freshly dead that when you put salt on them, it activates the potassium channels or whatever in their muscles and causes their muscles to twitch. So they put salt on them and they just writhe around like they're still alive, and you eat them in that state.
I'll give you a potassium channel. I was just going for a joke. I think Skull Island might be, I'm not going to spoil the next two movies, but I think Skull Island might be my favorite of the four.
I mean, I will just go ahead and say it. Of course it is. So I would, you know, I would give this movie a B+ on entertainment value. It's definitely, I will watch it again, whereas I can't really see watching the first one again ever.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. I would definitely recommend Godzilla to people digging into monster and kaiju and whatever. But me, like, popping it on in 3 years as a Friday night? No.
Yeah.
Skull Island? Sure. I've seen it several times recently, but I definitely could see revisiting it or showing it to a friend. It plays like, you know, a lot of movies aim for this, but it really succeeds in playing like a long Saturday afternoon matinee. And that's what it feels like. And when it's over, you're like, yeah, that was mostly empty calories, but boy, for 2 hours, I had a ball.
Yeah. And the coda at the end. Not the
post-credit
scene. No, not the post-credit scene. I'm talking about, like, I think it's under the credits or it's right, you know, the John C. Reilly getting to go back and meet his son and his wife. Like, it's just, I don't know, it's beautiful. I wanted to see that. Like, I didn't know that I wanted to see it until I saw it, and then
it is sweet. It just feels like it's from a different movie, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I don't know. But, as the character that I cared most about in the entire movie, I wanted that for him.
Yeah. I appreciate the effort.
And it's, you know, there's no dialogue in it. It's just visual. It's pure visual storytelling.
It also feels like maybe they showed it to test audiences and every single card came back, we want to see the closure of the John C. Reilly character, damn you. Yeah. And they went, okay, well, here you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would also give it a solid B+. One day I'm going to ask Jordan if an hour was cut from this movie because it works. I mean, you know,
wouldn't they have released it by now if that was true?
Not necessarily. I mean, maybe, you know,
there'd be a director's cut.
Maybe there's never any intent to but it just feels like a lot of it was, as a fan, I would like to see if there's a longer version. Release the Vote Roberts cut. That's what I'm saying. Hashtag.
At the same time, I think part of what makes this movie better than the other ones is that it does kind of, it does move.
Yes, it definitely does. I will give it that.
So I don't know that I want to see the 4-hour version of this.
But, you know, and again, but that kind of taps into like the appeal of a director's cut. I've seen this movie, three or maybe four times now. I like it very much. And I would now be interested in seeing a longer cut. But maybe, you know,
I guess that's true.
I don't think that necessarily it would have been a good idea to release a 190-minute version.
All right. So that, I guess, wraps up the first of our 2-part series on the MonsterVerse. Join us next week or next episode when we talk about the 2 remaining movies in the MonsterVerse series, the Godzilla King of the Monsters and the very recently released Scott.
Godzilla versus Kong. If you are a huge fan of Godzilla and you want to read a review of every single one, you can go to my Patreon, which is patreon.com/Scott E. Weinberg. And you can go there and it's $3 or $5 or $100 a month. And you can read all the stuff, every single one. And I'm going to add a Godzilla versus Kong review soon once I get my attention span back.
Yeah, that's right. You recently went through the entire, all 30. How many are there?
Oh, God, don't ask me off the top of my head. More than 30.
Oh, okay.
But close.
More than 30. Yeah, I know. There's like 38 or something like that, including these ones. So thank you guys for tuning in and join us again for part 2.
Thanks.